Had enough of the been there, done that ideas? Tired of too much talk and so little action? Rewind now and welcome to Transformation and Change Radio with Dr. Kathy Obair, where the vision of true equity, inclusion, courage, and purpose meet powerfully. Dr. Kathy delivers with dynamic, engaging conversation and the most authentically brave dialogue on air today. This hit show will challenge you to explore current issues of diversity, equity, and inclusion and deepen your capacity to choose courage to speak up to greater inclusion in everything you do. Fasten your seatbelts and accelerate your effectiveness to become a powerful change agent in your life, community, job, and society. Imagine true equity and inclusion and get the tools to really manifest your vision. No frills, no fluff, just really powerful, good stuff. Transformation and Change Radio starts now.
Hello, and welcome or welcome back to Transformation and Change Radio. I'm Dr. Becky Martinez, and I'm here with my good colleague, friend, mentor, Dr. Kathy Obair. And there's a lot of things to talk about as we think about class. And so we have this as just the two of us. For some folks that have tuned in before, you know that we've had a guest or guests. And today we're here to talk about designing and facilitating workshops on class and classism and how we can better create more class inclusive spaces at work, at home, with colleagues, with friends. And given the current moment that we're in, as Kathy and I were talking about before we hopped on, is it would be a disservice to our work in this show and your learning and your engaging in class with if we didn't bring up what's happening around student forgiveness and student loan cancellation and what that means, because I know that so many of my social media outlets have been filled with various degrees of buy-in or resistance or anger or joy around student loan cancellation. And let's be very clear, it's a small percentage, right? $10,000, maybe $20,000 is still so very low and small for folks that have debt from undergrad, grad, you know, all kinds of loan debt they may have acquired throughout their time in education. Kathy, any thoughts from you?
So glad to be with you again in our part two of designing. And thank you. It was you that said we need to do this because I was not focused on, and you know, I'm the privileged group and you grew up in more marginalized. So a couple thoughts. If listeners are like, yeah, but, and they have some of those arguments, I want to suggest, whether it's Twitter, do some reading and reflection, because there are several things that have been blown up my Twitter feed. So the PPP loans were forgiven from the pandemic. I hadn't realized, because as a small business person, I applied for 2 months, got one. It covered about one third of the income that I'd lost from the pandemic in those 3 months. And I was grateful. I hadn't realized how many folks in Congress, how many people got 4 million loans. So it's like, do some research and wondering, and how come there wasn't a blowback against those loans, which probably went to many, many people with many privileged identities. The other, if people are concerned about this, how come, where were you when was that $1.7 trillion yes. tax cut, that most of it went to uber wealthy and wealthy? But the two other pieces that got me, and Becky, you probably knew all this, but the whole thing about compounded interest, which I still don't understand, but that so many folks end up paying far more than the original loan because over time, and they did something to shift that, I think. And the final point that really got my attention was my age group and a tad older, when we went to college, it was far more affordable that on the incomes that at least middle-class folks were making, people could afford at least public, if not community colleges. And so the kind of debt that even community college, particularly four-year public, much less private, is just so different. And wages have not kept up because in 1980s under Reagan, people said, somebody, and they have the quote from someone who worked with him that said, if we have a quote, formally educated electorate, they will be aware of issues and they will vote that way. So those are just a few of the dynamics around class and classism and history that I saw. Hi, thanks for bringing it up.
Yeah, I appreciate those different layers that you brought up in regards to this conversation and this topic around student debt. As soon as it passed, I'm somebody who's probably in $60,000 or so in debt. I've paid so much in interest. I don't even know how much it's like the loan amount's going to be. And I mean, I'm 50 and I probably have 10 to 15 more years to pay these loans off. Yes. And I make a good salary, right? So I have all of the degrees. So I text a good friend who has a doctorate also. She's a Latina woman. And I was like, hey, this cancellation. And so we both quickly looked online, as I'm sure a lot of people did, to see what the requirements would be, to see how it would impact their like lives. The student loan companies, their websites went down because so many people were looking on their websites. And then as we dug a little further, we're like, oh, we don't qualify. And that is probably because of when our loan was taken out, but also the amount of money that we earn, because it's a $125 ceiling for folks that are single, which is a lot of money, $125,000. And like our expenses are so much, right? As single people, paying the loan, like the loan is a big chunk of the money that we have to make to give. And $10,000 is good. And it's so small in comparison. I text, you know, my nephew and I was like, $10,000 of your loan should be paid off. And he's like, how do I find this out? So there's been just so many people that I know that have reached out to me or that have contacted me in some way, or we've been talking about this and the impact of our lives just at the individual level. Right? And being able to find out information and when is the application and taxes. Like, so the amount of paperwork that may need to go into doing this. And if you understand to navigate the system, I think very similar to the PPP loan. And so I know that I was in conversation because I'm right there with you, Kathy. I was able to take a small PPP loan out. It wasn't just the paperwork, but it's the angst to do the paperwork. Whereas I had some friends who weren't as anxious to do that. And then it was the angst to apply to have it canceled. And depending upon what bank you're in and depending upon if you have a tax accountant or not, like there's these systems that are in play that made it very easy for some folks to get millions of dollars, even though it's like, how do you qualify as a small business? And it's a $1.2 million loan that you took out that was actually just, you know, canceled. And I like this very much reflects how we do class in this country, right? How we do class as small business owners, as individuals who grew up poor, working class, who may now earn a good salary in the organizations in which people are listening to us. And there's so much behind that story, right? There's so much that people don't know about individuals' finances. And so I'm so excited for my nephew, right? But I'm like, dang, $10,000 would be awesome to get off of this space. And I've been paying these loans for 12 years.
What I don't know if it's 125 gross or net. And so I haven't heard anyone. So if it's net, that will actually have a lot, which means after expensive, if you're like an independent consultant.
Totally.
So you've helped me realize how much is not known under the headlines and how many ways this could be used to keep people from getting access.
Oh, ooh. Yeah. Yeah, so much access, right? I'm also in the process of trying to buy a house, or at least looking for houses. And one of the lenders texted me and said, if you could pay your student loans off, right? That would help your application. And I was like, there's no way I can do that. like that's a non-negotiable, like there's no way. And so as we think about buying homes, There was just an article in the Atlantic yesterday or today around like people aren't starting families. They're only able to stay in certain jobs because relocation would cost money. And if they're paying $700, $1,000, $250, and relocation is just not possible from a financial perspective, then the degrees are awesome and it's not allowing the spaces that we can go into. And I also want to recognize how classed this conversation even is to have the access to student loans to be in higher education. So it's complicated.
It is. And you reminded me, not only did my dad get the GI Bill, which impacted his master's degree, our loan for the house, which then had them be able to accumulate some more money. So when I got a car, I had them come look at this used car I was going to find in college. And my dad goes, no, it's not a good car. But then they got me a used car. So, they may have paid for insurance. So how many folks who lived middle class, upper middle class, had some support from family? And particularly if they were white, the data clearly shows how much more wealth white families have compared to Black, Latinx, Indigenous. I haven't seen on Asian American. I bet that will play out, whether it's from islands, so Pacific Islanders, but still there's class variation, even though the stereotype is model minority. And so that's a whole nother conversation of how many folks have grandparents, parents, trusts. My parents had died at some point and my grandmother had resources died. So I was able to inherit some money, and some of that actually we used for our down payment of our first house. And so as we just kind of breathe in, listeners, what's been your life experience? We're just hitting some of the dynamics and just the unspokenness of class and classism. We don't talk about money, how much we have, inheritance, legacy, out of that shame or not wanting people to come after us.
Well, so as I hear generational wealth, and how do we not, I would assume, right, that generational wealth can come with some, it comes with great privilege and can come with some feelings. And so if people are conscious, there could be some guilt. People could be like, hell yeah. And, you know, and so I think that there's the range as we think about generational wealth. There's been some, so in the last 2 days, because there's so much been going on, they've been talking about the qualifications and how much the mostly I've seen brown and black folks in regards to how this doesn't help as much as folks are thinking that it helps. And we're just focusing on this cancellation. And as you said, so then how are we talking about class and money in very direct ways? Because I'm still hearing it being a really kind of a theoretical space that folks are at. And I know on social media, there's been that people have been sharing their student loan stories. And so how do we talk about it? So how do we just not talk about our story, but here's the money. And here is the impact that has on me. And here's what I can do. And here's what I can't do. Here's what I wish I could do. And here's the possibility isn't there at all, or there is. And so how are we being more clear, even our organization? So how I'm thinking of the listeners now, how are you talking about this moment in your organization with folks that are across the class spectrum, folks that have gone to college or haven't gone to college? What are the dynamics that we're paying attention to? What's the language that folks are saying? Are people talking about it? How do people feel about it that have paid their student loans off? It feels kind of like a hazing ritual, right? So I went through it, so you should go through it. That's some of the things that I've heard. And I've read some stuff around people are so overjoyed because their kids or their, the generation after them or the generations after them have a little bit of relief, a little bit. And are we talking about that right now with the folks that we work with?
So as you're listening, if you're still like, how do I have these conversations around the water cooler for at lunch? I just want to encourage you to keep learning and growing on social media. Because the other thing you're reminding me is while that money was, quote, forgiven, that means that other resources folks have will be able to be used in different ways, which will benefit everyone. And so it's not an either or. The monies will still be going into shopping, will still be going into paying tuition, you know, will still be. So just everyone breathe. If you're feeling uncomfortable, these are not easy conversations generally for folks to have. And maybe it's even just be able to say, well, you know, I have a different opinion if someone comes in with a pretty right-wing perspective. Say, well, I have a different opinion and I want to encourage you to do some research. I'll do some. I'll be glad to come back and have a conversation in a week or so. You don't have to do it right then if you're feeling like frozen deer in the headlights. Or just say, we may disagree on this one. I'm thinking of the generations to come that'll have a very different life than I've had, and I'm grateful. So. Well, that was something. Was there more you wanted to say before we leap into other things?
You know what? I would just say stay engaged with what's going on right now. And if you are resistant, or as Kathy said, if you are of the differing opinion, take a look at what that class story has been for your story, as well as the generations before you, to get to this space. Because there's lots of privileged folks that are like, I think that people should pay back what they took out. And how are we having that broad conversation around PPP loans with the EIDL loans that came out 2 years ago for businesses, like the emergency loans that are soon to be paid back, are starting to pay back October, November, December of this year, supposedly. So there's all of these parts that are... there's a lot of puzzle pieces to this conversation around class and government and loans and cancellations and forbearance and forgiveness. And so I invite you to engage, learn, talk, be in it.
And research what's not getting said, because as I heard you, I still don't know how many billions are given to different corporations, whether it's oil and gas, agriculture, so those government subsidies. And I just need to breathe a moment. Having this conversation in a workshop, because this is part two, designing, facilitating. If you're doing small group team conversations, organization-wide, voluntary conversations, look at part one, because we got into close to microaggressions. We started talking about that, and just reminded that entering talking about student loans could have people with very different opinions arguing. I wouldn't recommend starting there. And so we did some scaffolding from the class story and many other things, definitions. And then it's my belief, as I've done work on race and other issues, that folks in the privileged group can come into this conversation with their heart opening as they hear more about the unintended class comments, practices that actually leave people feeling like I don't belong, I'm dismissed, I'm disrespected. And so we wanted to start this time with a little bit more about, so how could you teach about, gather as well as teach about microaggressions, those daily indignities that are all around us that often go unseen, recognized, and particularly engaged?
Yeah. Shall we unpack that question a little bit?
Sure.
Yeah. So I think microaggressions, and there's been many people throughout the shows that have just talked about language, right? Just talked about language. And because language then informs how we navigate, how we define, what we assume, and how do we like kind of shift language or have it be different expectations for professionals, right? And so as I think about microaggressions, just in the language, like professional or dress code or how we're showing up or those are little things that make the back of my hair stand when I hear that. And as you said, how do we interrupt that, or how do we name it? Let's just not name it. like, oh, when we've had this conversation around professional, and then we just continue the train moving, we haven't really talked about what that means and the impact of that. Like, that's a strategy, right? Name it in the moment, not blame folks. Say the impact that it has on me. Oh, it's making the back of my hair stand up because of. And so let's talk about what that means and how that term is utilized in our, like on our website, or how we recruit, or how we expect people to show up, and how we expect folks in the different work, in if there's layers in the organization, right? Who do we name as professional and who do we not name as professional?
I love that. That could get some people wondering and then have them reflect. So what are some of the other comments that could lead people who grew up poor, working class, who are currently living that experience, whose income is a poor working class income in our organization, who's in a hierarchical position, because it's usually top gets more money all the way, quote, to the, and say, so what are some of the comments, the offhanded comments that you've seen or heard, who we include in decisions, and to get individuals to come up with a few, and then maybe small groups, and then the large group share. I think we talked last time that if you wanted to put together a list of common class microaggressions, have people look at that as homework and then come in saying, yeah, I've seen this, I've done this. And then to your point, so what's the impact when these occur? That could have people breathing and realizing it's not our fault. It's around us. And now it's our responsibility to recognize and shift and interrupt in the moment. The professional, all those being one set of them, but there are so many more.
There are. And I think a skill for that is, I don't know if it's a skill or a tool, to recognize like intent and impact. And so many people can spin and do spin when then they've been confronted with the term that they've used. I mean, even in higher ed, no, in nonprofits too, I get the, well, I just have a bachelor's. And the impact that can have on folks that work in the organization that don't have a degree. And it's like, well, what do you mean by just? Right. And so then people start spinning and they're into, I didn't mean to, right? Like, I want to recognize that, but they stay in their intent that I didn't mean to, rather than, oh, well, let's talk about what that impact was for you. Cause they don't want to be seen as classist or racist, but in this, you know, space, it's classist or elitist, because who wants to? And like, that's part of your story. And so how do we talk across class when these microaggressions happen? And the complication with class is that there's such a spectrum. There's your class of origin, there's your current class. And so that's where it gets really complex and harder to filter than maybe some other identities. And so then people are like, I'm outie. I'm not going to do this.
You just gave me another idea that we had the class journey early in a workshop series. This could be a time to have people's pre-work go back. When you were growing up, what were some of the classist negative comments around you and or microaggressions about, oh, I wish I were rich. So kind of rich people have everything. So just class comments, because that might be easier to talk about before we then talk about what could be going on here. And to be honest, some of the ones from our early years are probably still operating, but it's that it's a little distant. Well, I heard this in elementary school when I was my first job, I heard this, I used to say this, and so I'm not that anymore. And then that'll teach other people. Once groups kind of have it's really a grounding in, it's okay to name these, talk about the impact, as you said. And then usually there's energy of, I don't want to do this anymore. And I don't want you to be impacted anymore. I'm not saying everyone will have that energy to want to be a change maker, but enough people probably will. And then the conversation about, so when have you stayed silent and why? And there could be some class dynamics. I could get fired. I use my supervisor that said it. When have you spoken up? So they get that strength based. And then looking at a whole bunch of generic tools. And on my website, /resources. So drkathybaird.com/resources. Lots of different webinars and packets that have just generic ways to interrupt microaggressions that might be useful to interrupt class ones. And then practice,
right? And one of the things that we have to think about is a lot of people don't engage, right, because they don't know how to. And so how do we build our skills and competency and confidence in knowing that we may mess up? And so that is one of the things. It's like, okay, like this is already messy. So let's just be in the mess together and have that be a norm and okay, as opposed to needing to show up perfect, right? All the white supremacist and white ways of being in organizations with a class lens on it. And let's not freeze, because that's where people, particularly in this conversation that we're not supposed to talk about because it's taboo, are just like, okay, I don't know what to say. I don't know how to say it. Practice it.
The list of tools I have, I say to people, go through and which ones have you used? Which one could you imagine using? Mm-hmm. Then they come back and share that. And then also ask, which ones would you never use? Because it's kind of Kathy O'Bear speak. Because if someone analyzed those tools, it's probably a very middle, upper middle class academic speak to it. That's where I mostly, not only who I am, but it's where I mostly work. And so I just encourage people, whatever sets of tools you have people look at, let them critique them and then make them their own. And then some scenarios, 10 general scenarios that could happen in the organization and small groups to practice. What could you do if some role plays that they come back and demonstrate to the group and critique and add to it? And then having teams come back to a couple scenarios, maybe once every couple weeks. What could we do if? Have people bring other microaggressions so they're practicing it literally over maybe 6 months, a couple times a month in your teams and your workshops. So it's an ongoing development.
I love that, right? And there are some, and maybe we can talk about this when we come back from the break, but there are some folks that there's some great shows out there that you can actually just show 5 minutes of a show. And like that can be your workshop. And that could be part of your workshop, because there are so many dynamics that exist in Superstore or American Auto, right? Blackish. Like I'm trying to think of some shows that talk about class dynamics in sometimes overt, funny ways, but just like hit you so that you don't have to create it yourself.
On that commercial, why don't we go to break? Dr. Becky Martinez, Kathy O'Bear, Center for Transformation and Change Radio. We will be back after a short break for more tools and strategies designed to facilitate workshops on class and classism.
Welcome to the Spacious Unknowing Network, Sunshine for Your Soul,
with Julie O
and JoJo Rose,
every Monday at 7 p.m. Pacific on TransformationTalkRadio.com. Let your heart beat in the rhythm of your soul and guide you to new horizons and unlimited, infinite love.
Heaven on Earth, your online school of divinity, building your inner coach as you lay down your foundation in the new earth with you as the authority. Take action now. The number one challenge people face every day is the negative voice in their head. We work each day to turn negatives into positives. It's all a matter of perception. Our challenge at this time is to remain intensely positive and focused, creating the world we wish to live in. Wake up on purpose with Cornelia's daily online positive messages guiding us in the new paradigm. Raise yourself into happiness and inner peace daily. Elevate your personal frequency, free from negativity, and reprogram yourself step by step, shifting your energy patterns with positive repetition, daily building your new earth with someone you trust. All the heavy lifting has been done for you. Wake up happy with Cornelia Stephanie VIP.com. Try free for 7 days now.
Can you truly say that you know and love yourself? Corny Cottrell is an author, speaker, and 21-year active duty master chief with the U.S. Navy, here to encourage you to take back your power and live your life with intention and purpose. Tune in to Unapologetically Favored every fourth Thursday at 11 a.m. Pacific on Transformation Talk Radio. Walk in your purpose. Visit unapologeticallyfavored.com to learn more about Courtney.
Hi, I'm Mary Jane Mack, and I'd love to tell you about the latest technology of the Velara Company. I've been using the Velara Company equipment, the air machines, since 1992, and I have found them to be totally successful in killing mold, mildew, and keeping your house fresh and clean. If you'd like more information on it, you can look at MaryJaneMack.com. or call our office at 888-777-4232.
There's a beautiful story of Princess Damayanti and King Nala. It was traditional that a princess chose whom she wanted to marry by placing a garland of flowers around his neck. Damayanti was so beautiful, intelligent, and accomplished that the divine gods themselves wanted to marry her, but her heart already belonged to King Nala. Knowing this, many gods attended the choosing ceremony, perfectly disguised as King Nala. Damayanti, seeing many Nallas seated around the grand hall, became inwardly still and quiet and prayed for guidance. She was blessed by the power of her love to see through the illusion. She placed the garland around the neck of the real King Nala, whom she loved. Join me, Sarah Main, on Damayanti, the show for your soul, to learn how to let the power of love cut through the illusion. And check out my website, damayanti.store.
Well, welcome and thank you for joining us again. We had left off talking about how we could incorporate shows and use clips of shows to have class workshops and conversation. And I had named a couple of my favorite, which are Superstore. Sad that it's not there anymore, but there's lots of seasons. American Auto, Blackish. There's a, I think there's one that's called the Abbott Elementary. And so there are these, I guess I gear towards the comedy pieces of those shows, but they're so intense class discussions in there that people are just laughing at or are quiet at. And so how can we take pieces of that? I also have an 11-year-old nephew that I get to spend a lot of time with, and cartoons, right? Or preteen shows. There's class woven in those. And I think, what are they watching? Right. And so what are little people consuming that we need to pay more attention to with the class lens? But also then how can we take those as adults and talk about that? Right. And then you have this intersection of age and class, and like, how lovely would it be to talk, have a workshop in your organization around class and age with kids shows? And then how we talk about that with younger generations, like, that makes me excited in ways that I hadn't thought about until right now.
Me neither. And that might get some people in the door to a workshop. If you start with parenting, aunt and uncling, and how to support young people growing up with more analysis. And because as I think back, I'll bet most shows I watch and still watch are middle to upper middle class, if not wealthy, portrayals. Mm-hmm. I think Roseanne was one of the first intentional shows,
yep,
that showed white. There might have been others. And then when I think of that humorous, and when I look at it, it's just painful to watch. And so I'd love to give people homework. We'll save a series of five or six of these, right? Give people homework to watch. If you have young people, watch what you watch with a class lens and come back and report, and maybe bring a little snippet of something if people know how to do that. Because how folks with more resources are talked about and seen as important and in charge, and folks with fewer resources, not only criminal, but also not as smart, just the classes bias that we talked about in earlier shows are just so in these movies and TV shows. So use it as homework and then have people come back and share.
And that is like, I think that would be a lovely entrance into having conversations around class. That may feel less intimidating. And then like, let's just delve into our stories. Cause some folks are like, oh, and we consume media in TV. And there's probably some radio shows out there that have class lenses to that. So I think it's a lovely idea for homework.
Woo-hoo. Your organization might be able to have space to move, acknowledge the interpersonal, what we're consuming, how it shows up in conversations, meetings, and then bump it up to, that's the language we use, to get it to the systems level, policies, practices. And I remember Dr. Carmen Rivera and several other folks talked about some of the unwritten rules or the ways we just do hiring or money. So what are some ways in a workshop can we get people to raise their awareness about some of the systemic classist dynamics in society as well as in organizations?
Mm-hmm. I saw somebody post a couple of days ago of people not needing to like take all the time to accrue stuff. And how about if we as organizations just gave that from the get-go around like time off or vacation time or PTO, rather than needing to be there for 5 years or 10 years, like that would be lovely to be able to, how do we upfront some of those benefits rather than the longevity? And I get that needing to recruit and retain and the professional development that we put into folks takes time and like takes resources and not just from a money space. But how lovely would it be for somebody to know that they don't have to work 2 or 3 years if they want to go on a vacation for 2 days, right? Or if they want to, if they have a sick day, right? Like if they get sick, they don't have to like wait 5 months and then just struggle being sick. Like how can we upfront some of those pieces in our organization rather than needing for folks to feel like they are just on the like produce. Like that for me is some anti-capitalist spaces. That is, as people are hearing, like, what would that feel like for my organization? What would it have felt like for me? What does that feel like as the ED or the president or the director to even have that conversation that we know may be heated or challenging? And how do we do that anyways? Like that's some systems change. Whew.
And again, if you're thinking, I just want to raise people's awareness, one could, 5 practices like this, you have to have this much time to accrue this, and just ask the question, who, by group membership, who is this easier for? And by group membership, who is this really create barriers to be fully present and productive? And you might have to go a little broader than just class of origin and current class, bringing in race and gender and parental status and elder care and child care and maybe a few others, disability status. And so, or ask the question, what would it be like? What would the impact be if we didn't, kind of like Becky did, but have that be the dilemma that have people chew with and go, wow, what could be possible? And so bringing in, there are other organizations you know of that actually have shifted their policy, say, here's our current policies. Here are 5 other organizations that have it differently. What could be different if we moved in this direction? That could be a workshop conversation that might bring up all kinds of things, but it's concrete and shows where we are, what could be the impact of this practice that we pay executives this much. And when you start, you're paid $12 an hour and it takes you 90 days before you even get officially off of, what's it called? Probation.
Right.
So you could just wonder about the other thought I had, because I never would have thought of that without you talking about accruing. I remember learning more about the history of class and classism in the U.S. Now, that was in an academic social justice workshop. And I do wonder, whatever the organization, if you're a nonprofit, the history of class in nonprofit work in your organization, K-12, higher ed for sure. There's a deep history of classism that still plays out. Again, the intersections of race will probably come in for both strongly and others. And so just have people realize many people don't understand the GI Bill or other ways that whites were able to move into the middle class, or the FHA loans, and if I have that right. So some of that could, again, it's not personal, it's not organizations. It's like, wow, I didn't realize all the different class access, class privilege that went to some groups and not others. Those are some ideas I have.
And so class action has some, like, some, they're a nonprofit organization. They do really good work around class and across class. And so they have some of that historical piece written down. Betsy Lenard Wright. There's a book that she has that she's talked about class and the impact for poor and working class folks. So there's some really good literature out there that people can get a hold of, because I think people can get stuck of, oh my gosh, it's overwhelming. How do I do all of this? But how are there some small pieces to that? And I lit up a little, Kathy, when you said it would be awesome to do the like class history of the organization. Right. And no shame or blame, but like, how did the organization start? Right. How many people were there? How is it like grown or changed? Even if we just look at salaries or benefit packages or how many people, and then create critical moments. And so what allowed us to do, like what allowed us to have two more hires, right? Or what allowed like us to do this particular program with the community, so that there's a, like, internally folks can just see the trajectory of their organization. And what are any class-related moments? And there's going to be intersections, at least I assume there would be. But that is that's a lovely place to be able to play at the organizational level. Like, what has shifted? What has changed? Why did we start? Where is it at now with the class lens?
Ooh, and building on that new idea, who created?
Yeah.
And what were their values? And what were their expected norms? So what was their class background, and how did they most likely unconsciously bring in upper middle class, white, generally culture norms? How has our demographic shifted? How much does that play into professional, what that means? So just keep breathing, listeners. We're having fun brainstorming, but any and all of this is possible to have people then reflect, what are our current policies and practices, hiring, promotion, onboarding, discipline, time off, as you said, who can leave their desk, who has to stay so they can pick up the phone, and what are our assumptions, and how much of that is based in this kind of class factory system that I think many of our organizations might still be based on. Who gets the freedom to move around, who has to stay literally attached to the loom when you're making the metaphor, but you're making cloth. Who is under a microscope if they aren't exactly here on time, or they take a break that's 5 minutes longer, and who gets the benefit of the doubt and seem to be working? There are so many places to go with unwritten rules and the enforcement of policy. Who gets enforced? Who doesn't? And there's often a gradation by hierarchy, which is so connected to current wealth, income, class.
Yeah, right? Like, that is a, I think that that's right there. That's like a years long workshop series. And so the other thing is it doesn't have to be fixed tomorrow, because we can get into that mode really quickly. I think of our work, or at least some of my work with our good colleague, Jamie, is the model of awareness, knowledge, skills, and action. And so how do we not like become aware of something and quickly go to that action space? Like, it takes like, we're going to gather this historical context. And then maybe each point of the historical context can be engaged. Like, that's a year's worth of really good professional development, organizational work.
And every session could be some more awareness, mm-hmm. how does this show up unproductively? What could we do in the moment? How do we be long-term change agents? So if some folks are listening, it's like, we got to create some change. I don't want to hear, but right. You can put it literally into every 2-hour session. Make sure you have awareness, some skill building, some action without jumping to solution too far before people understand. Like the dynamics of class privilege. I know as a white person, I resisted looking at white privilege forever. And then when someone suggested I had class privilege, I had a similar bristling. I don't think I resisted as long because I'd already done some work around recognizing white privilege and all the different ways that doors were open for me because I was white. And again, if you're listening and you're bristling, just breathe. I think I had more guilt around class privilege than I did white privilege. I'm like, I was born this way. Mm-hmm. Class privilege has shifted for me as I have had more income, more wealth, more resources, investments over time. And so how could one do in a workshop, prepare people to get ready and then talk about examples of class privilege?
Mm-hmm. Well, and whoever is going to do that, like do your work on your own stuff before you go into that space. And so I've had the delight of working with Kathy for so many years now. And you often talk about, and this is even my story around race, like it takes time to develop the capacity to be able to talk about it. And so that we don't cause more damage. And so it's not just about reading a book or reading an article or talking with some friends. Like whoever facilitates this work needs to have enough capacity to be able to do that. And we don't want that to deter folks from doing it. And like you need to be clear enough to know, what am I uncomfortable with? What am I needing to unpack? Like what may be my trigger in the space? And that's why Kathy does such good work around triggers, right? What, what comes up for me? What's been my feedback? Like where are my emotions sitting in this space? All of that is a part of just facilitating this really important work. Go do some of those, like that awareness, knowledge, and skills to be able to get to the action. And the action may be like, I got to do some awareness, knowledge, and skills to be able to even facilitate a conversation around class. Like that's the action, right? Because otherwise, if we go just to the time, like to the, you know, the historical line, like that's not going to go well. Or it's going to stay very much in a theory space. And we're not talking about how it like practically lives in the organization.
And in our bodies. And so if you're co-facilitating, one model is often a privilege marginalized or several people, a couple privileged, because there's so many different stories. And then having that group of conveners, facilitators meet beforehand, experience every activity, do their deeper work, as you're saying, debrief, do the experiences you're going to lead the next time. Around privilege, I wonder, do you think class action has a list of class privilege that would be easy to access? Because I've seen lots.
I have not seen that.
Mm-hmm. So a thought, hey, we may put one together. Mm-hmm. I have a long list of white privilege, not only the Peggy Dr. McIntosh's work, but I've added to it, kind of making it more organizational. And also some of the lists of microaggressions that whites do. I wonder if taking those and then shifting it to class, it may not be as hard as it may be sounding right now, but those sorts of self-reflections of like, ooh, I've done that, I've seen that, or what kind of privilege is it when someone comes in a suit, I'm going to go work in a corporation, and it's my first time public, I don't know, 3-4 years. I don't think I've been public in a corporation in person in years. Mm-hmm. So I was already thinking, well, I'm going to wear my red jacket because I look good. It's a power jacket. And then I caught myself. So how do we treat folks who dress in a way that looks upper middle class compared? So class privilege comes out, dress, speech. We already said who gets the flexibility to run their own lives and schedules, who doesn't get questions. So to your point earlier, doing that in affinity spaces so that folks with either who grew up poor working class might be in a group or two different groups, people who grew up middle class, people that are currently in supervisor, manager, upper leadership. So you could even do it that way and have those conversations about, so what are examples of class privilege that exist here? What if you can collect them up on a Jamboard?
Oh, you probably could. I mean, I think that that would completely be possible. And as I was hearing you talking, for me, it's sometimes just the going out to dinner piece, right? And so like who order, like, can I order? Like I didn't grow up ordering appetizers. And so I go out with organizations now when they take me out to dinner and there's the expectation that you order an appetizer and you order the entree and you order the dessert. And so I have all of this class, middle class plus experience. And even when I go out with, you know, whoever's bringing me on campus or into organization, and there's this, it's like, okay, so what are they going to order and what is okay to order? And because for me, it's like, if I don't finish my food, is it okay to take it away as a, in a to-go box? But like, is my expectation I need to eat an appetizer, an entree, and dessert? Because I don't think I can eat all of that.
I can't anymore.
And people do. And so as the person who's brought in, right, or is that new employee, those little things of what is the norm in this organization? And I haven't been taught to or practiced to do these things that may be a middle class plus value. That are microaggressions, even though the organization may be well-intentioned to, I just want to take you to dinner.
So in a workshop, depending on what the socializing is, that could be the question. Friday afternoon gatherings, out to dinner with folks, if there is conferencing, and how are those norms classed, and how, what's the anxiety folks made the first, second, fifth, 12th time? And then how do we shift those? Someone had mentioned on the idea, if you're going to be doing birthday parties, right? Everybody chips in $15. And so all the different ways we do business, whether it's a nonprofit, a corporation, higher ed, K-12, that could have differential impact. Collecting those up on a Jamboard or Google Docs, mm-hmm. so people could do it anonymously, have them put in what are some policies and practices we need to analyze with a race class lens. See, I said race, but it might be a both and. Mm-hmm. So those could be ways in workshops to gather some ideas about an organization and then use them as activities for people to deepen their skills so that in the moment they can hear it in a meeting. That's what we're moving towards, is how can people be planning and have enough awareness to go, can we slow down? Could there be a class implication to that? Could there be some folks in our organization that would easily meet their needs and some that actually it would create a barrier, feel uncomfortable or anxious? And just asking those questions in meetings when we're planning, or to be honest, on the golf course where sometimes decisions get made, talk about class, mm-hmm. someone just needs to speak up.
And as the leaders of the organization, or if you have some type of privilege in it, being okay with whatever answer is going to come back, right? And so can we talk about it? Yeah, but like, how is the organization going to receive the answer and take action on the answer? Otherwise, people are just going to become frustrated and not want to say anything. And so leadership open enough to be like, okay, so we're going to do something with this feedback that we're getting or this conversation that we're having.
So that says, so the organizers, even before you do these workshops, mm-hmm. have those conversations with leaders, get their buy-in and commitment, and then make sure the confidentiality of the group is withheld right. So that you're meeting with leaders. If the group says, like, this is what we're thinking. If we do some charting or jam boards and we have strategies for change, which might be a part three, because we've got several more questions that could be done in a workshop, that the facilitators are the ones that share generically, these are the kind of things that came up. Or here are the ideas for change that came up. Right. I love that. So this is a system intervention, the workshop itself.
Whew. Right. And, and then how are we transparent with everyone in the organization that these are the conversations that we're having so that it doesn't feel right. It's just folks in the top that are having the conversation And so let's be transparent with the organization of how we're wanting to engage with the class and class, like a class lens. And so here's what we're doing in these moments. Know that we're going to bring folks in But they're very clear of the process, because as we think about class and positionality, usually the leaders are the holders of this information and don't tell other folks.
So listeners, open forums, not only before the workshop to see if even maybe you didn't have some conversations, you could have an open forum where you ask for microaggressions, those policy practices that people can write out anonymously. Then you have that data you can use in the workshop, and then say in the work twice, we're doing like six years, hope you come. But even if you don't, we're just going to have a couple open sessions where we as facilitators, maybe some group members, will come together and say, this is what we're learning, this is what we're doing, and these are some recommendations already we're having. And then at the end, here are some recommendations for the whole organization. That itself is disruptive of, I love that, Dr. Martinez. You go, Becky.
There we go. You said it so much clearer or different than I did. So thank
nice
you
catch.
For that. Yes. And that, right. And so I even think about how you and I interact and like who has the better answer, which is all kinds of like identity and class stuff. And that's the thing that we can talk about, right, in organizations. So I am loving this session, this conversation, because we have talked about it at individual group and systems, at least to a degree. So it excites me for folks to listen to it.
My guess is part three, we'll do even more around how do you engage resistance when you have it, and then some activities to help people envision what's possible, really talk about how close we are to get some energy for change, some unwritten rules. So we might get through the rest of these questions in one more. I hope you all have patience and really appreciating the brilliance of Dr. Becky Martinez, the new ideas that come to me while she's talking. Take what you like, leave the rest for now, and come back next time. Thank you all for joining us. We'll see you in the next month.
Go Wonderful. Well. Thank you.
You've been listening to Dr. Kathy Aubert on Transformation Talk Radio. Thanks for tuning in, and be sure to catch us next time as Kathy inspires listeners to become agents of change, motivate, innovate, and speak truth to power. Step into the courageous you that will change the world. Connect to life-changing conversations to extend your reach. For more information on Kathy and her work, please visit drkathyaubert.com. That's drkathyaubert.com.
Views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the station, its management, or advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.